Welcome to Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast. We're glad you're here. I'm Amy Hall, and Greg Kokel's here with me.
Hi, Amy.
Here to answer your questions. Hello, Greg. All right, Greg, let's start with a question from Robert McNally. If the wages of sin is death, Romans 6:23, and all sinned and fall short of the glory of God, Romans 3:23, how is it that Enoch walked faithfully with God, then he was no more, because God took him away without death, Genesis 5:24. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he did not see death, Hebrews 11:5.
Well, to me, this is not really complicated, because what is being described there is a consequence that God brings upon those who have rebelled, all right? That the wages of sin is death, is something that God built into the, not even built in, it's not even maybe the right word, but is that's God's decision, all right? He made death be a consequence of rebellion, all right? Now, God can make exceptions anywhere he wants in the things that would naturally follow. This is what, I mean, miracles are examples of this. And so there's no question in my mind that Enoch was a sinner, because all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. There's only one exception to that, and it's a specified exception, and that is Jesus of Nazareth. Now, when it comes to the idea of death being the result of sin, there was, in a sense, the principle of death. Enoch was growing and moving towards death. That would have been the natural course of his life in virtue of being a fallen son of Adam. God intervened in that, all right, like he did in Hezekiah. He gave Hezekiah 18 more years. Hezekiah was going to die. God intervened and lifted that, in a sense, natural sentence of death on Hezekiah's life for another 18 years, all right? I don't see any reason why God can't lift the sentence of death in the sense that this is the physical consequence of sin in man's life in an individual case like Enoch, all right? And so it just doesn't trouble me. I guess it is a specified exception, but it doesn't change the rule. In fact, you only have exceptions if there is a rule. And this is the question. Why, if there's this rule, is there this exception? Well, a lot of that's in the mind of God, but it doesn't trouble me, because this is a decree God has established that he can make exceptions to whatever he wants.
And in fact, at the end of time, there will be a whole lot of people who won't die, but they'll be changed and meet Christ. So there will be a lot more people than Enoch who won't experience death at the end of time.
Oh, you know, I had not even thought of that. That's such a great example, a great point. All of the rapture crowd, as it were. Now, I don't care for the word rapture. I think it's misleading, because it implies a separate event from the resurrection, when in fact the so-called rapture passages like 1 Thessalonians 5 and 1 Corinthians 15 are resurrection passages, and that's what they call the event. But nevertheless, the importance of that particular event, popularly called the rapture, is not to move people from one place to another. Like, what's the point of bringing them up when they just come back down again if it's a post-trib rapture? And the point is they've missed the point of the rapture. The rapture is not to move people around, it's to transform them. The age is over. Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, 1 Corinthians 15. Therefore, we will all be changed. That is, all who are still alive, and change from the mortal to the immortal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a great point, and it just goes to show that these are things that God is free to do, and though there's going to be a whole generation of Christians that are alive at the coming of the Lord, who will not see death, but they will not be transformed from perishable to imperishable, that's the dead being raised, but rather from mortal to immortality. They will be resurrected, so to speak, without having died first. That's a great point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paul says we will not all sleep, but we will all be changed.
Yeah.
And the reason why this can happen is because Jesus tasted death for all of us. So there's no injustice by God offering grace to some, even before Christ came, and having them not actually die because of the justice in Christ.
This should be the Amy Hall show. You totally trumped me on that one, Amos.
All right, let's change topics completely. This one comes from Natasha in Canada. My church has two services on Sunday morning and has decided to offer one of the services to vaccinated people. The decision is based on being compassionate to those who haven't attended in over 18 months out of fear for their health. I can appreciate this, but I think it comes at a great cost to the unity of our church. Could you offer your opinion and guidance?
Well, I'm not sure. Let me just try to back into this a little bit. I'm not sure that it violates the unity of the church. All we have is two different services. Some people go to one, some go to the other, and sometimes they switch around. So I'm not sure in what sense the unity would be sacrificed if, let's just say, one service is for people who like old timer music, and the next service is people who have young timer music. You know, that's the way services are divided that way a lot. I don't understand. I don't even see how it's an act of compassion, frankly. And I'd be interested to hear more about that. But just the fact that there's going to be divided two services, one for the vaxxed and one for the unvaxxed, that doesn't strike me as. It seems like an accommodation of some sort. I'm not sure what the accommodation is accomplishing, because people who are vaxxed are not at risk from being around unvaxxed people. And people who, so for the one, it isn't like, okay, we're vaxxed, so separate us from the unvaxxed people because they're dangerous to us. Well, they're not dangerous if the vaccine is protecting you, all right? They might be dangerous to each other, but they're not dangerous to the vaxxed people. And the vaxxed people aren't dangerous to the unvaxxed people, presumably. This makes no sense to me. Plus, here's the other thing that I have read in many, many, many places. Getting vaxxed does not stop you from vectoring the disease. Getting vaxxed protects an individual in some measure, but it doesn't stop a vaxxed person from vectoring the disease to somebody else. So the idea that you can't come into this restaurant and you're vaxxed makes no sense, because it suggests that vaxxed people are safer people in the restaurant. And I have seen this statement from many sources, and many of them reliable. That is, vaxxed people can still vector. So I don't understand the whole can't get in without a vax passport mentality. I guess none of this makes any sense to me, this church's policy. I don't see in the least way how it's loving. Maybe you can explain it to me. I don't see how it's necessary, and I don't see how it creates any division either. So if they want to do it and they feel better about it, I don't see any problem with it. But there is this misconception that vaxxed people are somehow safer to be around. And the fact is, vaxxed people can get sick, for one. So it isn't like a vaxxed person isn't carrying a disease that they will later, in a couple days, show symptoms of, because that can happen. It's just hard to know. And that's my general response.
I think this is a tough question. But first, before I even go on, Greg, I think you're right that this is not at a cost to unity, specifically since right now there is a cost to unity because they're not coming. So if you're going to say that having a different service for them is a cost to unity, there's already a cost to unity. There are people who aren't coming because they're afraid. So that's, I don't think, a consideration. And this is... such a hard situation for churches, and I actually appreciate them trying to make room for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty is, like you say, Greg, there are a lot of people who think this is over the top, and I think there are good reasons to think this could be over the top. But I've also seen churches that are so unconcerned about COVID that they're overly dismissive of the needs that people have about their health, their medical concerns, and they're not making any sort of accommodation. They're not opening windows. They're not nothing. Like there are some simple things you can do to accommodate people who, especially people who have very specific health needs. Mm-hmm. I feel really bad for people who have some sort of risk factor, and they can't come to church because their churches are being completely they're just completely disregarding any sort of mm-hmm. of measures taken. So this is a really thorny question, but I think you need to take into consideration people's health concerns and do what you can to bring them back. Now, in this case, what they're asking for is something that is exclusionary. They want to exclude people who aren't vaxxed from that service. I don't think that's ideal. I think it would be better to find a way to come together where they can have some sort of measures to ensure people's safety. But, you know, maybe there's another way to come together. Maybe everyone can gather outside afterwards. Now, this is in Canada, and that makes it more difficult because of the weather. So there are just so many factors in this situation. And I don't even know what the rules are in terms of the government there now. I think things have gotten worse since I received this question. So all this to say, I don't think this is a totally easy question to answer for everybody, but I think that people should try to find ways to have people who haven't been able to attend to come back, especially if there are serious health issues. Anything else to add to that, Greg, before we
No, I mean, I think that there's what's unfortunate is the follow the science dictum is impossible to apply. And the reason it's impossible to apply is that scientists are not allowed to speak if they do not act in lockstep. This has never happened before. It has never happened. Well, I guess it has with regards to the issue of evolution, where people are silenced because they're not going along. But this is a public health issue. And everybody who has qualifications should have their say so we could figure out what's best. The dictum, follow the science, started almost 2 years ago and was rapidly, obviously, and quantifiably rapidly ignored. It went by the wayside and politics took over. And this is called moving the goalposts, and everyone who is watching is aware of that. All right. Now, I'm not going to weigh in on all the details, but I do know, and so does everybody else, that there has been an aggressive attempt to silence dissent. This is never a good thing with regards to health and stuff like this. And so therefore, it's you got to dig really, really deep to get enough information to make a genuinely educated scientific decision. It's hard to find the information because so much of it's simply being silenced. And that's not conspiracy. We know this is happening. It's right out there in the open. Okay. Now, why people are doing this is another matter, but it is right out there in the open.
Mm-hmm.
So
it is frustrating. All right, let's switch topics again. This one comes from Brooke Stock. Luke 9:59-62. Jesus asks two people to follow him. One responds by asking to first bury his father, and two wish to say farewell to, or the second one wishes to say farewell to his family. Yet Jesus responds very harshly to both. How can we reconcile this with Jesus being compassionate? Does he also value family bonds?
Here's my first impulse here. Is to encourage people to quit thinking about Jesus being compassionate. And it's not that he's not compassionate, but the concept of compassion in our current milieu, the way we think about things has so much baggage onto it that I think we inappropriately place upon Jesus. So, Jesus is compassionate. Wow, if he's compassionate, how could he make such a severe demand? And the answer is, he's not compassionate the way you think he's compassionate, or the way the modern culture thinks compassion ought to be expressed. And this is a huge problem, in my view, generally speaking. The culture broadly has domesticated Jesus. Okay, Jesus, meek and mild. What a difference between the Jesus of the New Testament and the God of the Old Testament. Have you ever read Jesus? I just finished reading Matthew 23, 24, and 25. Matthew 23 is filled with aggressive woes, like, woe to you, woe to you. And I noticed Jesus calls the Jews a brood of vipers. I thought that was John the Baptist. Well, it was, but it wasn't just John the Baptist. It was Jesus. And then he talks about the temple coming down and will be destroyed. And this is in Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse, and all of the things that will assail all these people. And then the next one, he has the parable, verse chapter 26, the parable of the virgins, and they are left out. And in fact, the virgins, oh, let's just see, there's another parable in there too about the wedding, and those who are guests don't come, so they go to the highways and byways and collect everybody, anybody, they bring them in, but then there's somebody who's not dressed properly. And so Jesus has him thrown out in outer darkness where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth. Okay? Wow, where's the compassion in that? What people do not understand is how severe Jesus of Nazareth is. And he is severe because he is the king of the kingdom. And he sees the world in a very different way than the rest of the culture sees it. Now, just as a point of information, when the person says, "Let me bury my father," his father's not laying there as a corpse on the table. And Jesus is saying, "Leave him rot there. Let the dead bury the dead," or whatever. He does use that phrase, but leave him rot there. Come with me. This man's father is not dead yet. The phrase, "Let me bury my father," means, "Let me wait until my father dies. Then I will be the head of the household, and then I will follow you once my family moves on," whatever. Okay, now, as far as the other characterization is concerned, what was the, "Let me bury my father," and what was the other one, Amy? I don't have it here in front of me.
The second Luke, one, wishes to say farewell to his family.
Well, I'm not it's so Luke, sh- yeah. Go ahead.
Luke 9, 59 through 62, she says.
Luke, okay, I'm almost there. Luke 9:59 said to another, "Follow me, Lord, permit me to go bury my father. Allow the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God." Another said, "I will follow you, Lord, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home." Jesus said, "No one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God." Now, I can't tell you about that phrase because I don't know. The one before it, I do know something about that. This one, I don't know. And I don't think that Jesus meant, "No, you can't go back and say bye," whatever. Keep in mind, by the way, that Peter followed Jesus, but Jesus spent time in Peter's home. He healed Peter's mother. So they were moving from house to house of people. They were involved with families. Something else is going on here that I think is akin to the first question. Notice what Jesus said. You want to put your hand to the plow, you don't leave it again. So I don't know that verse, that statement, that comment made by the man, taken in our parlance, makes Jesus' response look severe. I think it had a different sense in that time. That's my suspicion, because Jesus saw it as not keeping your hand on the plow. Now, Peter had his hand on the plow, but that didn't mean he couldn't go visit his sick mom. So I don't know how to weigh in on that so much, except for just offer those thoughts. But I think the bigger problem is reading a personality into Jesus that is affected by modern sensibilities, or current sensibilities, I should say, and not by biblical sensibilities. Jesus terrified some people. When he stilled the sea and he walked on the water, he did that thing. The disciples were terrified. Who is this man? They fell down and worshiped him. Okay, and so there are other occasions that are like this. He said very severe things, and this is what we have to understand Jesus as doing. We can't mold him into our own character. I've just written a piece that's coming out January 1st. No, it just came out. Wait, when is this? Which one did I just do?
January 1st.
Is that the one?
It's not out yet.
Is that the one on, no, that's on political.
Which one are you talking about?
The one I just, that came out December 1st is The Legend of Jesus.
Oh, okay,
the,
yes.
The social justice Jesus. And this is a perfect example about how people mischaracterize Jesus in a way that's consistent with the culture, but has absolutely no basis in the historical record of Jesus' life. This was the most stunning thing for me when I went through all the scriptural texts pertaining to this question that I was examining. I didn't expect to find many, but I did expect not to find many verses supporting this idea. I did not expect not to find a single one, which was the case. There wasn't a single verse that supported this characterization of Jesus as being this compassionate Jesus who was a defender of the poor and the outcast and the marginalized. It's not there. It isn't what he did. So that all fits, I think, in the same category here that we're concerned about.
And I'm sure that brings up questions for people. So go check out that piece. It's on December 1st, The Legend of the Social Justice Jesus. What I wanted to say about this, Greg, is that when I think about someone looking back, the first thing that comes to mind for me is Lot's wife. She looked back at the place where she was coming from rather than going to where God was taking her. And so that could be part of the imagery here that Jesus is invoking with the with the idea of looking back. But it's important to remember that it is compassionate. If you're defining compassionate in the right way, in the biblical way that's informed by truth, it is compassionate for Jesus to call for people to put him first. Jesus is God. God calls us to love him with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to not put anything or anyone else above him. So when Jesus says that, when he puts this demand on people, this is totally understandable if he is God. And it's compassionate because that is the way we are supposed to live. I think about the rich young ruler. The interesting thing about the rich young ruler story is that even though Jesus says in that same vicinity, and I can't remember where this is found. I should have looked this up beforehand. But he says the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. In that framework, along comes this rich young ruler, and he says, what should I do? He asked Jesus what he should do, and Jesus says, follow the commandments. And then the commandments he lists are all the other commandments that have to do with us and other people. So do not lie, do not steal. I can't remember which ones he mentions, but they're all in the second part. He doesn't even mention love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So then the rich young ruler says, well, I've done all these things. And then Jesus says, but now sell everything you have, give to the poor, and come follow me. And what I think Jesus is doing there is stating the first commandment, which is you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And he was showing the rich young ruler that he did not do that. He loved his things more than God, more than Jesus. And so what he's doing there is saying, follow me, that is the most important thing. That is compassion. In fact, it says in there that Jesus loved him. He looked at him and he loved him. It was out of love that he was saying, I am above all else. I'm above all of your stuff. I'm above all of your family members. If I'm not in the proper place, then your life will not be right. You'll not be right with God. You'll not be right with other people. Therefore, it is compassionate for Jesus to say, put me above all else. And that's all I got to say about that,
Greg.
Well
put.
Well, thank you for your questions. We got through three today. That's great. Thank you, Natasha, Robert, and Brooke. We appreciate sending in those questions. You can send us a question on Twitter with the hashtag STRask, or you can send it through our website. Just make sure it's short and that it includes hashtag STRask. You go to our contact page, send it directly to us from there, and we'll consider it for the show. We really appreciate you sending in your questions because we cannot do this without you. And we're doing this for you, so we want to hear from you. We want to answer the questions that you actually have. Well, thank you for listening. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.